listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. We bring you this special edition of Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we chat with Peter Phillips, who's been on the show before. Peter is a professor of political sociology at Sonoma State University, and he's a former director of Project Censored. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with Peter, and he'll be talking about his latest book, Giants, the Global Power Elite. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Peter Phillips, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Well, thank you very much for having me back.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you again. It's been a couple years or so. So, and thank you for reaching out to me. Before we get started, reacquaint our listeners with a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a professor of political sociology at Sonoma State University, and for the last 25 years. And for about half that time, I was director of Project Censored and put out 14 annual yearbooks on the most important news stories not covered by the corporate press. And then for the past several years, I've been involved with Project Censored and doing the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Network, which was a lot of fun, with my co-host, Mickey Huff, who's now the director. I kind of have retired from a lot of the Project Censored work and really gotten back to my original research interests, which is elites mm-hmm. and power, which I teach classes in as well. And my new book is called Giants, The Global Power Elite, which is about the top 300 players in global capitalism today and the impacts that they have on the world and the amount of money, not only who they are, but the amount of money that they control. It's massive.
Right. And that's what we're going to talk about today. There's a question that it says, who holds the purse strings to the majority of the world's wealth? And, you know, that's a question I believe that you're answering. I'm sorry, I haven't read it, but, you know, I did read some reviews and things like that about it. But is this the question you answer in the book, and why is it significant?
Well, essentially, we're talking about capital money and how it's invested worldwide. And it's concentrated, very highly concentrated. We know that there's a great inequality in the world. Lots of people know that. Mm-hmm. But the degree to that that's occurred, particularly in the last decade, is just amazing. There are 17 giant investment companies. That's where the term giants come from. And these are companies that have over $1 trillion of investment capital. Now, think about a trillion. A trillion is a thousand billions. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of cash. And they're representing the wealth of the top, like, 1,000th of 1%, the billionaires and 2,000 plus billionaires and about 36 million millionaires. And then just generally they handle money for pension funds and things like that. But it's concentrated in these 17 giants, who collectively in 2017 had $41 trillion worth of capital that they were managing. And what's amazing about this is, one, there's only 199 people that are on the board of directors for this amount of money.
Wow.
So it's a very small number of people, which we identify all of them by name and who they are and their business affiliations and where they went to school and their private wealth and their policy groups. So that's a first. But more importantly, that concentrated wealth is impacting and is protected by governments, the intelligence agencies, the American NATO empire worldwide mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is protecting the free flow of capital and capital investment. And that's significant because, you know, we're talking here probably $50 trillion today, a very concentrated wealth.
Holy moly.
Managed just by these few hundred people.
Right.
And that wealth, their biggest problem is they don't have adequate investment opportunities to guarantee a return. So right. they end up doing speculative investment like the subprime mortgage loan problem they got into, mm-hmm. you know, a decade ago that practically bankrupt the entire system. And it hadn't been for the central banks worldwide and the Federal Reserve in the U.S. bailing them out with trillions and trillions of dollars, we would have had total economic collapse. It's inevitable that we're going to have those kinds of problems because you can't continue to concentrate wealth and find good investment returns forever. I mean, it's just not possible. So governments help out in that regard. One of the policies that Western governments have implemented is austerity. That means they spend less money on people
right.
and humanitarian concerns and allow greater investment by private interests into public resources. So whether it's water rights or freeway systems or they allow the privatization of literally everything, patent rights, I mean, just anything that can offer a return could be privatized. And we're seeing that very, very massively. We're also seeing the privatization of war. And war is another way that capital can be used to guarantee a return to these investment companies. So the U.S. has, you know, bases, 800 bases worldwide, in cooperation with NATO, is working in Africa. We've got troops and training troops and military actions going on in 140 nations worldwide. That's not to protect the United States from terrorists or the people here. I mean, that is to protect global capital's penetration anywhere in the world.
Exactly.
And there's to be no resistance. So the government is resisting profit-making and capital penetration. It's time for a regime change, and the U.S. is getting very good at that. So Gaddafi was taken out primarily because he was trying to sell his oil and encourage other African nations to sell their oil and gold. And that created a, you know, a conflict in Europe and the U.S., and so they took him out. They created a resistance movement and funded it and then went in and did what they called humanitarian intervention, and now Libya's right. in chaos.
Right.
So, but that is war on behalf of global capital. And I think what we can really look at, going back to 9/11 and the justification for, you know, in the invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq and the wars in the Middle East, have all been about, you know, revenge and protecting us from Al-Qaeda and terrorism. But terrorism is primarily people who are resisting capital penetration and military control in their own homes, in their own communities. So they, you know, people resist, we call them terrorists. So that's an ongoing problem with concentrated wealth in the world today, is that it is maintained in a big part of that is through war. And right. so we have permanent war, and yeah. people are dying everywhere. And mass inequality occurs so that now we have, you know, the top 20% own 95% of all the wealth, but it's the top 1% that own half the wealth in the world. And the bottom 80% of the people live on $10 a day or less. Most of the people live on $3 a day in the world, and a quarter live on $1.50.
Jeez.
So those people, those billions of people, 30,000 of them die every day from malnutrition and starvation. So there's this massive inequality and a massacre of people daily from lack of nutrition when there's more than enough food in the world to feed all of them. You know, a third of the food in the world is thrown away because it's not deemed profitable to sell it. So we have really become a non-humanitarian society, and capitalism is making that worse. By allowing the continued concentration of wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people, and encouraging and protecting those returns, and encouraging those returns politically, militarily, and through laws, transnationally. So the World Economic Forum is where the big capitalists get together every year, and they all meet each other and they knock around. But there's policy groups. Like the council, Council of 30, mm-hmm. which I call the Executive Committee of Global Capitalism. This mm-hmm. is 33 central bankers, big economists. 32 of them are men. There's one woman.
Wow.
And they have $1 million budget, and they hire staff and they do reports. And when they put out a report or a policy recommendation to the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Bessel Committee, any of those groups that are controlling international trade and investment, it's seen as instructions. It's not seen as a policy recommendation. The president of the World Bank will take a look at what the Council of 30 is saying and see that as, this is what we need to do. So I call them the Executive Committee of Global Capital, and those 32 people are definitely included in my list of the most powerful people in terms of the world power elites. But there's two other advisory groups that are very important as well. The Trilateral Commission,
right?
Which is was originally Rockefeller funded in 1973, and it has 40 nations from the world, representatives from 40 nations. So there's like 400 people that are on it. None of them are in government. In fact, you can't be in the Trilateral Commission and be in government in your country. So they are business leaders. So it's all privately managed. They meet annually in New York, but then they meet regionally in Asia and Europe and Americas. And they're in constant communication, putting out constant reports of what they believe the policy for capitalism needs to be. One of the reports of 2015 was calling, it was about the containment, return to the Cold War containment with Russia, because they were saying that Putin was misbehaving, so to speak, and that he was seeking to do his own empire again. And so that was a justification for what we've seen now is expanded military saber-rattling with Russia, conflicts all over the world. And they have openly said in that report that they didn't think we could work with Russia unless there was a change in government.
Mm-hmm.
So they were calling for a regime change. They want Putin out. And they're salivating because capital would love to penetrate Russia, would love to get into those oil supplies and those gas supplies and the mineral wealth that's widespread in the Russian government. I mean, the Russian country.
Right.
So it's massive amounts of possible investment opportunities that they're very much interested in seeing capital penetration there in a much bigger way. They work with the Chinese. The Chinese are allowing some capital penetration, but one of the big stumbling blocks right now is these tariff things that have happened. But the tariffs are really a pressure to make China allow capital investment into their companies and their inside China above 50% of a company's value. So the major investment groups they're very interested in China and being able to invest there, and so there's pressures to have that kind of opportunity as well. So what we're looking at is global capital controlling the world, creating and building itself on wars, and all of us are negatively impacted by life's reduction of opportunities, decrease in public resources that we could access, and increased and wages that are going down because we're competitive with the entire world. So we're in a really wrong track situation, which Chris Hedges and others have called, sort of a state of fascism or a neo-feudalism, where the corporations are like the kings,
right,
and royalty in the Middle Ages, and are now so strong that it's a feudalistic type society.
Peter, you said that there were three organizations. You mentioned the Council of 30 and Trilateral Commission. What's the third?
The third one is the Atlantic Council.
Oh.
Again, a private organization funded with money from corporations and foundations, made up of with representatives from the NATO nations, with a high emphasis on security and protecting global investment. So if you look, we looked at the executive committee of the people there, the 35 there,
mm-hmm,
and they're half major investors or working with one of these giant affiliate investment companies, and or they're security experts in some capacity, a lot of military, prior military people, but high-level security operatives, including private military. Like we all know about Blackwater, now called Academy.
Right.
The biggest one in the world is G4S. In fact, G4S out of Great Britain has 625,000 employees.
Holy moly.
And is the second largest private employer in the world behind Walmart. So they do security, they do private military, they can do killing and invasion raids in countries protecting corporate resources. They create green zones protecting corporate employees anywhere in the world. They guard banks. They were the ones with the dogs up in Dakota attacking the people protesting the pipeline there.
Right. Wow. It seems to me, this is just like so overwhelming. $50 trillion in wealth. I remember back when, at the end of the Bush regime, I think maybe in 2008 or something, I was reading about the derivatives and how, the banks were investment bankers or whatever were creating these massive amounts of derivatives. And I said something like, I had read something like $8 trillion worth. And this economist from Texas wrote to me and made me feel so stupid. He's like, there's not even $8 trillion worth of wealth in the world. So Like, so it seems
no,
like
that's, they're wrong.
There, it seems
there's
like there was
$250 trillion
only,
dollars worth of wealth
yeah,
in the
it,
world.
But that this was back in 08. I have no idea. I thought I was
even
right.
Then they were wrong.
But yeah. But anyway, it seems like their only purpose of existence is to create wealth for themselves.
Well, the purpose, I mean, capitalism is like riding a bicycle. It has to keep moving forward, or else if you stop, you fall over.
Right.
So, and that's called stagnation, and that's a depression, and it could be worldwide, and it could be quite catastrophic. And for the people on the bottom, instead of 30,000 a day dying from starvation, it could be hundreds of thousands.
Right.
And, you know, and combine that with the what we've looked now, we've got maybe, 12 years to turn CO2 around and try to accommodate the catastrophic change of the weather and the global environment. That's not happening under capitalism. They just want to keep pedaling forward. And if green investment's profitable, they'll do it. But that's not the emphasis. They're still burning coal. They're still burning gasoline. And encouraging that capital return that they get from those materials. So that's we're faced with environmental collapse and economic collapse, perhaps simultaneously, sometime within our immediate future. We're not talking here 100 years from now. We're talking a decade from now, within our life expectancies. And for a young person, for sure within their life expectancies.
Right.
And for their grandchildren, certainly even more so. So that at the end of the book, we have a letter to the global power elite, and we've identified who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Say, okay, this is who we know who you are. You are in positions of power that you could change global capitalism in terms of its continued concentration of wealth. And you could make some changes that could affect the environment. And you really need to do that in the capacities that you have, if you think that your grandchildren are going to have grandchildren. So we're appealing to them to make the changes that are necessary. I mean, they believe that continued capital growth is going to solve the problem, that we'll grow ourselves out of global inequality. It's just not happening. It's going the opposite direction.
I don't even understand. So, that doesn't even make sense from somebody who's not a professor.
Well, they say it's going to trickle down.
You know? Oh,
but
well, yeah, that's never happened. And I mean, I remember Reagan. But so the thing is to me, is this wealth has to be positively redistributed to... For you know, to
oh, absolutely.
Stop,
that's
to
what we call it. Needs to
this.
Be. We say there needs to be a river of capital flowing down to all the families in the world.
But they're so greedy; they want to hang on to that. That's the goal. Capitalism. The root word is capital, and that's what they care about. And that's what their goal is: to have everything, not to just to have their share, but to have everything. So you know, Chavez called these people the squalid ones, the squalidos. How do we how do they even have any humanity to appeal to? What could be positive steps that we could take today, Peter, to make sure that that happens?
I think that I wrote this book to identify specifically who these people are.
Mm-hmm.
So the 389 people listed in the book are the central core managers, protectors, and facilitators of global capitalism worldwide. Now, having said that, and knowing who they are,
mm-hmm.
There's a structure there. So that is what we're going to be able to address, and social action groups and political groups need to be able to say to these people specifically, you need to do something about this. We are concerned about what you are doing. So we've seen protest groups in front of Larry Fink's house, his apartment on the Upper West Side of New York. He's controlling $6 trillion of wealth through BlackRock. So environmental groups have been protesting outside his apartment, him and Jamie Dimon's both.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just two of these 300 people.
Right.
They need to be influenced and changed because they want to continue to privatize everything, including Social Security.
Right.
So, I mean, that's their goal, and they think that they can privatize the world. So I'm not sure we can change their minds. We're going to have to pressure them. We're going to have to identify who these people are and pressure them politically through social movement groups and a variety of any other way that we can and say, you got to stop this. You have to fix this. And if you don't fix it soon, you're going to see environmental and economic collapse to the point that the world may not exist. People may not be possible for humanity to exist. There'd be massive civil unrest. I mean, if there's an economic depression worldwide, the civil wars and the unrest that will come out of that will be immense.
Right.
And they have their private armies. People will die.
And then these people have their private armies already.
They do. And I think sometimes they think, well, I could be protected or I can go buy, you know, land in New Zealand and nobody's going to bother me kind of stuff. But ultimately, it's going to reach worldwide.
Yeah.
So, you know, so, and like Bezos has invested in SpaceX, and maybe he thinks he's going to go colonize Mars or something.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, but that's insane. It would destroy the world for a few. That's something that we can't allow to happen.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I always remind people that they always say, oh, the U.S. hasn't won a war since World War II. Well, they're not meant to be one. They're meant to be continuous, right?
They're meant to use up capital and give capital return to elites.
Right.
Yes.
And another question I have for you is, how does the figure of Donald Trump play into all of this as, you know, a capitalist himself and, you know, as a so-called businessman, how do you think he has affected this, you know, because we saw this concentration of wealth. You say that, I read that between January 2016 and January of 2017, the number of people with as much wealth as half of the world fell from 62 to 8. And I know that was during the Obama regime. And I know that, like you've explained, that, you know, that there's more powerful people in charge of these things. But how has he affected things, Trump?
Well, Trump, presidents are functionaries for the global power elite.
Right.
I say that quite openly because all the presidents, even going back to Carter, and Carter didn't quite go along with all their agendas, so they were undermining him in a variety of ways. The intelligence agencies were in that. But it's to protect concentrated global wealth is a president's top agenda. He's not going to say that.
Right.
But that he has no other choice. And Trump has been quite good at that. I mean, he's lowered taxes. He saved them trillions of dollars on taxes, the tax reform bills. He's allowed the banks to reinvest in speculative investments where Obama had blocked some of that after 2008. He's spending militarily. He's droning the world and killing people everywhere. So he's a functionary for elites. They're happy. They're essentially happy with what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they're worried about his irresponsibility and potentially getting this into a nuke war or something like that. But I think they feel like they've got enough control in terms of the military and the functionaries there that won't happen. I certainly hope not. But, you know, so overall he's accepted by Wall Street and the elites because he's profitable. He allows them to keep going. This stuff about, you know, a border wall, things like that. I'm not sure they're necessarily opposed to that.
Oh, right.
They want to, you know, they don't, frankly, probably just don't care.
Right.
So, and they don't care about abortion. They don't care about some of the social issues.
Right.
Gay
marriage.
They care about capital.
Like that. Or so,
right.
I always say whoever wins, you know, wins, put in quotation marks, the presidency of the United States is certainly acceptable to Wall Street and the war machine, and the people always lose, and they always win. So
under our current system, that's absolutely true.
Right. Well, definitely.
Absolutely
need,
true.
Definitely, we need a different system. Well, Peter Phillips, what's the name of? Tell us the name of your book again, and where people can find it.
It's called Giants: The Global Power Elite. It's from Seven Stories Press. People can order it online through ProjectCensored.org, and it's available at bookstores all over the country. We just went to second printing, so that's exciting.
Nice.
The book is going to come out in Spanish and Portuguese, Korean and Turkish at this point.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we're excited about that.
Yeah.
And it's doing well. It's kind of word of mouth, so to speak, and it's got no corporate media interest whatsoever.
Well,
nobody's talked about it or even criticized it at that level. But it's starting to pick up academically, and we're excited about the that and through word of mouth and people reading the reviews and that it's I think a very important book that has a whodunit kind of thing in it and names people specifically who are involved.
Great, Peter. I did transfer it to my Kindle, so I will be reading it because I'm interested in stopping it. You know, it's like I have grandchildren.
Yeah.
I have grandchildren. And I want them to have a safe place and a secure place and a prosperous place to grow old in. So anyway, Peter, and you said the corporate media, they're the propaganda arm of the global power elite, right?
I call them the ideologists.
Yeah. Okay. Peter, Happy New Year. And it was so good to talk to you. And
great to talk to you, Cindy. Thank you.
Thank you for the subject in this book. And it's inspired me to do more work in overthrowing the system.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's the Soapbox this week, and as always, I hope you were informed and inspired for further action. And that was our Soapbox number 348. Now I am counting two more until a magic number of 350. So I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Peter Phillips for his work and for his book and for inspiration to dig into this topic further, and how can we overthrow these global elites, make a more fair and equitable society. I'd like to thank you for listening to and supporting the show. Please go to cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com for links that are relevant to this program. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.
Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Not long ago, the political left were the guardians of free speech. Along with big tech, the left today has gone from protecting speech to enforcing speech, even to the point of penalizing you if you say the wrong thing in public. You can lose your job and livelihood. Welcome to the era of simply shut up and nod. crosstalking enforced speech. I'm joined by my guest, Emmanuelle Gave in Paris. She is a French lawyer. In New York, we have Lionel. He is a legal analyst and a news decoder at LionelMedia.com. And in Lake Jackson, we cross to Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. All right, let me go to Daniel first here. We're pretty much the same age here. I remember growing up, and it was a time of being sensitive to people. Let's put it that way. There are certain words in our vocabulary, I'm sure it probably exists in French as well, is that things you don't say. And I think you know what I'm talking about. And you know what? I thought that was all right. I think that's cool.
Yep.
All right? All right. But in the last few days, we had a Virginia teacher fired for using not using the preferred pronoun of a student. And then we had a Texas elementary school teacher who refused to sign a pro-Israel oath is fired. Now, this is enforcing speech. It is not protecting speech. How did we get here? Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I think we got here partially with the idea that somehow the state could keep all of us safe. And I hate to draw everything back to foreign policy, but I think a lot of it had to do with the concept of preemptive warfare, the idea that through the application of force, we could create a perfect society. And I think that concept, that idea has permeated, unfortunately now permeates the left, to weaponize our own thoughts, to weaponize our own thought processes. If you control what someone must say,
exactly,
then you control how they think, you control their mind. So I think it comes from the idea that the use of force is okay if it makes you safe. And of course, ultimately, as we know from foreign policy and from force speech, it doesn't make you safe.
Well, Emmanuelle, I mean, what is happening right now is not, it's simply a rejection of the very foundation of Western civilization. Now, I know there's a lot of millennials and all of Hollywood and all of the universities hate the idea of Western civilization, but they have everything they have now because of Western civilization, a topic from another program. But they want to deny freedom of speech, and they are intentionally, actively undermining freedom of speech. Emmanuelle in Paris, please.
Yes, well, actually, if you think about it, somehow, there's maybe nothing new under the sun, because if you think about the logos, since the ancient Greek philosopher, since Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, it has always been said that he who controls the logos would control the political life of the country.
Right.
And we have seen that best than ever in the 1984 George Orwell, when they create the Newspeak. So now we have this whole population in Hollywood that you were referring to, of people that are, in a way, orphans of the late tyranny, of the late that was USSR. So they thought, well, what could we invest? And they thought, well, we will invest in a new type of world. We will create our new speak, and we'll make this new war about one side is the planet, and the other side is this gender war, and trying to put against all the values we have, the notion of country, the notion of family, even the word of nation. And it has been done for centuries, if you think about it. And dictators in Europe have been very good at creating new languages, from Hitler to the USSR in the old days. So controlling the logos, in a way, is something that Antonio Gramsci, the Italian philosopher, used to say. Control the world of the education, the words, and one generation later, you will have the power in politics. And this is what is happening, which is why we need us conservative, to react and say, no, we all know what you're doing, guys. We've seen it before.
Yeah, what they'll try to do is they'll get you fired, okay, or you'll have to go somewhere else. Lionel, the wordsmith on our panel here, I mean, Daniel hit the nail on the head here. This is a form of mind control, and as I said in my introduction, and if you don't agree, then you have to shut up and nod, okay, or there'll be penalties, and they're serious ones. Go ahead, Lionel.
Well, we have, you know, in the world of nature, normally things go extinct or become extinct. Here, we have new species that pop up. And these new species, these new chimeras, are an amalgam of social justice warriors, virtue signalers, and others who get together and they create what I call not the thought police, but the thought vigilantes. And what they are is these are citizen mobs, ochlocracies. As Gustav Le Bon would talk about this herd mentality, like murmurations of sparrows and starlings, that they move. And today, the more allergies you have, the more sensitivities you show, the more that you can show, I'm upset by this word. Here are my allergies. I don't know if you've ever met these people, but they're not this. These are people who show allergies to this word. I have a new word. My pronoun is, that's the way you say it. It's a clicking sound. And if you don't say that, I will not only disagree with you, I'll have you fired and removed from humanity. Now, I move up the pecking order because I have another allergy, another overreaction, and I am more upset and angry over this. And we turn this into a fad. It's how many allergies do you have? We should have like a fruit salad, like they have in the military, to show how many words and how many things upset and annoy you. That's really how we are. It's the thought vigilantes.
You know, Daniel, it's you know, not only the rejection of freedom of speech, but actually the rule of law. This is what I find terrifying. Look what happened to during the Kavanaugh hearings. Okay, this was this herd, and it was one of the most profound moments, I think, or an indication of how far it's gone. An accusation is a conviction. If you don't call me something that I want, then you're a transphobe or a bigot or a racist. I mean, this is this amazing slippery slope, and it has real consequences, because then you do lose the rule of law and the right to self-protection. I mean, I'm offended every time I turn on cable news, okay? But that's okay to be offended. When you're offended, you learn, okay? That's how I know how to push back, okay? Listening to all their jargon, they do not want you to think, they want you to repeat. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, and I think the core of this is really the rise of the concept of collective rights versus what's been cherished in Western civilization, individual rights, individual liberties, and with that goes individual responsibilities, which you alluded to, of course, at first, words that you would not say because you're a polite person. But the whole concept of collective rights is about the destruction of the individual. It's about using force to force someone else. And if you are using that force, if the individual no longer has any value as an individual, then truth itself doesn't matter. And I'm glad you brought up the Kavanaugh hearings, because even when falsehoods were exposed, the adherence to this group rights mentality said it doesn't matter if they were lying. The concept of what they were pushing was right. And I think it's fortunate that we have a French guest here, because I think a lot of this idea goes back to the French Revolution. The whole concept of truth, the whole concept of reality, of existence, was turned on its head. And that's what we're seeing now with the rise of collective rights. Collective rights really is another word for authoritarianism and tyranny.
Emmanuel, how do you see that? I mean, we're basically three Americans and we have a French person, so maybe you could give you the angle there. Go ahead.
No, I think it's very true to look at it. I mean, looking at it from my European perspective, I see that it's the first time in common law history that you have what we call in French une obligation de faire, which means you are obligated to do something, usually from freedom of speech. And the case law that was developed from the Supreme Court was to say you can only, there is nothing that refrains you from your freedom of speech. The only thing, it shouldn't be a hate incentive. But right now, for example, looking at the federal laws that have been passed in Canada, the idea now is that if you do not use the pronoun, it will be considered as a hate crime. So you have a total inversion of the proof, of the system of proof. You now have, as a person, to, if you're a teacher and you do not use the pronoun, to maybe prove in a court of law that your reality, what you see with your eyes, but you're going to have to take a lawyer to plead that, to say that you cannot say something that you don't see, which actually seems like common sense. It's very difficult to, but that's what they want to do. They want to enforce on someone something that seems unreal. It's a little bit like in the time of Galileo, you know, when he used to come to the Catholic Church and say, "E per si muovo," but it moves. It's the same idea. He looks at the planet and says, "But no, look, it is turning. It's not the sun that is going around the Earth. It's the other way around. It is moving." But they said, "No, this is not the reality, because us Catholic Church, we have the real logo." And it's the same thing today. Those people, those progressists, they want to tell us that what we see as real is not really real. How come? Why? Yeah. I don't see why they have the truth. They don't want to stay in an empirical demonstration.
Well, I mean, and also, let me finish up here with Emmanuel. I mean, empirical reality is being denied. This is what's really quite terrifying. I mean, if I tell you I'm a salad bowl and I want you to call me a salad bowl, I mean, then you would probably think I was out of my mind. But if we were in Canada, well, I suppose that's a gender category right now. A salad bowl, okay? It is just absolutely preposterous.
Did you see lately?
Go ahead. 20 seconds. Go ahead.
There was a case in Denmark. Yes, there was a case in Denmark just recently where a man wanted to change his age because he considered he was not 63, but felt... Yes, because he felt he was 43. So he was asking to change on the register.
Well,
because
no, he was,
said, that's what I
he
feel
was
like.
Looking for dates
what's,
on.
What's
he was looking for
that?
Dates on Tinder, okay? All right, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Enforced Speech Day with RD.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Lionel in New York. This enforced speech concept, what it does is it denies dissent, and it actually denies real political debate because the terms and conditions of the debate are predetermined. So the outcome, if you control the language, you will get the outcome you want because you've already predetermined the outcome using a very confined and controlled discourse. Go ahead, Lionel.
One of the topic of hate crimes came up and hate speech came up. And one of the problems that is always missed is that in our country, we will take a law that is cognizable at law, let's say battery or arson or murder, that is punishable. And we will then take that, and if you couple it with something that is constitutionally allowed, permissible, for example, to hate. Peter, yep. I may hate you. It's okay. Just don't hurt you, touch you, or call you salad bowl in a mean way. But I can hate. So if you take something that is already a law and you aggravate it, basically you aggravate the sentence or the charge because I've dared to add to it a constitutionally permissible thought, namely hate, you're penalizing thought. The thought police are very, very alive here. Very interesting also. You take these poor prosecutors, of which I was one, and it's tough enough to prove the case. But, Peter, not only now must I prove that you intended to do something, but I've got to prove to a jury why you did it. And if you are very clever and you keep your mouth shut or you do not record the motivation behind your hate speech, then I have to guess. And what I'm doing is I'm asking a jury to penalize you, not just for what you did, but for what you thought. This is already going on right now, and the worst part is Americans don't even see it.
Okay, well, Daniel, intentionality is almost impossible to prove, but I guess now that's turning into a legal category all by itself. Ask General Flynn. Okay, but I want to go back to this this attack on dissent. It is outlawing dissent, and the political discourse is so confined right now that if you don't meet the terms and conditions of the debate that they want, then you can't participate. You're disqualified automatically. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think, it does go back to the idea of group rights. And what happens with group rights? Who gets group rights? Well, the loudest people get group rights. The loudest groups get group rights. And how do they enforce those group rights? Which, of course, always come at the expense of the individual. They enforce it through the state. They use the state as their bludgeon. So what does that do to us as individuals? It makes us literally the property of the state. We go back to a concept that was certainly wide throughout the Soviet Union, and I remember still talked about in Hungary when I lived there, the concept of the wooden language. We begin adopting a wooden language because we're afraid to speak in a clear way. We're afraid of who we might offend, and so we actually end up destroying the language itself. And I think that's absolutely where we're heading. And the concept is group rights. But people should realize that the totalitarians that are pushing this should realize once they establish the concept of group rights, those groups can change. And we know through history, favored groups can become disfavored groups. There's already a backlash in Europe and in the United States. Thankfully, it's not yet violent. But if you look at the popularity of someone like Jordan Peterson, for example,
yep.
the professor from Canada, his huge following of silent, I would say silent majority, who can sense there is something wrong
yep.
and are afraid to speak out. And so they follow someone like that. So I think you're already seeing a backlash.
Yes, I agree. I go to Emmanuel in Paris. Jordan Peterson is a perfect example. Is that, you know, what he says is really not quite extraordinary. It's so common sense, and it is so clear. And it, you intuitively understand. It's like, yeah, that's what I've been thinking all along, okay? Emmanuel, one of the things, I lived in communist Poland. Daniel said that he went to communist Hungary. And the language was wooden. He's absolutely right. But the difference in the West is that it's all glitzy and glamorous, okay? And it's virtuous, okay? You get the big tech, they're censoring people, throttling people, disappearing people. Hollywood pushes their nonsense agenda, amoral, illogical. They're at the very center of this, and governments work with them here. I mean, we have the good thing is it might be a circular firing squad. All we have to do is duck every once in a while. My point is the array of forces against free speech are immense. Go ahead, in Paris.
Yes, I think in a way, if you think about it, in the last 30 years, changes from Clinton to W. Bush, from W. Bush to Obama, it was the same logos. They were all using the wooden tongue, as you were referring. But I have great hope in the sense that I might not be a Trump lover on everything, but Mr. Trump, President Trump, when he came to power on the back of a very different and new logo. He calls a cat a cat, and when he doesn't like something, he says it loud and clear. So I think a lot of the power that came within Mr. Trump is also the redefinition of common sense. He doesn't use a very special word or anything. And in my French view, when I look at President Macron, he is the opposite of that. He's somebody who was made totally artificially. And we see that with the common people, which is why we had this gilets jaunes crisis, the yellow vest, because people are aware nowadays that there is such a difference between them and this type of oligarchy, which is really something that could come from communist Russia in the days, or from Hungary or Poland. It's this caste, and we have that in Brussels also. This caste of very, very chosen elite with their logo, their speech, and they decided one day to think of a world that would be transgender and that would be post-humanist. And if us citizens, we have something to say about it, well, they might consider it, but maybe they have another day plan, agenda.
Because, Emmanuel, it's because
because
they're morally superior to us, right? That's what they believe. Deep down, they believe that they're morally superior to us. Let me go to Lionel. You know what the yellow vest found out? They found out that Macron's brain is made of cork, okay? They found out, okay? And it is, okay? It's not even wood, it's cork. It's even less quality, poorer quality. Lionel, Emmanuel said she's optimistic. I'm not very optimistic here because of the array of forces that are against it. I mean, if you look at these social media platforms, they can disappear you in broad daylight. Okay, you can lose your job for using the wrong pronoun. I mean, I can't go back and live in the U.S. I don't know. I probably get arrested at the airport for some reason. Go ahead, Lionel.
Oh, I would highly advise against that, Peter. I'm your dear friend. I would stay put. Let me just put it. But let me tell you this much, though. You know, when you see a teacher who is in a kindergarten class or who is in a class for shop or something, and the teacher has to swear not to promote anything that would impede Israeli trade, and you're wondering, what does this have to do with kindergarten? Or why is this important to use a particular word? I'm teaching shop. What the reason why I'm not at all optimistic, in fact, I'm pessimistic, is that right now in our culture here, it is a sign of, it's like the neck tattoo. I used to laugh. I would say there's no way people will ever tattoo their face and mar their face permanently. Well, so much for that.
So
when something becomes fashionable, and now people, as you know, we're having snowflakes and people use various terms, but it is now becoming fashionable. And I hope that one day this mighty pendulum swings the other way, but I don't think it's going to be for a while. Because right now, I am applauded by me having more, for example, you know, these allergies, where I am against the following, and where I tell you, I will sit back in a class or at my work, and I will wait for you to comment, say anything. And not only am I going to be applauded for being hypersensitive, and not only having you reprimanded, but removed, expunged, obliterated, ablated, you know, disappeared, but I'm going to be held to a higher societal status because I'm showing my peers I am more sensitive than you.
Oh,
I am more easily offended than you, and therefore I maintain a higher position.
Yeah, you know, Daniel, this whole identitarian political strategy, it caves in on itself. I mean, you put everybody in these little boxes or little tribes and all that, and then you look for the least advantages, the most virtuous. I mean, it is Marxism to its core. It's just, you know, it's the same old bottle with new wine, okay? Identitarian politics inevitably caves in on itself. Okay, and it's only a matter of time here. I mean, I take the Benedict option and just stand aside and watch these people destroy themselves, because they will. Inevitably, they will. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, it does go back to the concept of trying to achieve perfect safety. You talk about coming back to the U.S. You may not get arrested, but when you get here, you're going to have some guy groping you, whacking your genitals, taking away all of your individual rights because they got to keep you safe. And that's the idea. But, you know, I come down in between being pessimistic and optimistic. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah.
But I think it will ultimately get better. Just look at the issue with the Texas teacher. All of a sudden, people are waking up saying, hold on, in 26 states in the U.S., I'm not allowed to say I'd rather not buy Israeli products because I don't like their internal policies. What the hell is that about? I'm an American.
Daniel,
and I think you're going to have a lot more people starting to think about it.
What is interesting is that at least now, Americans can criticize their own government, but they're not allowed to criticize a foreign government. What is going on with that?
Exactly. You can even call for the overthrow of your own government. You just can't say don't buy Israeli goods because they're terrible to Palestinians. I think people are going to wake up. I think common sense will prevail. Unfortunately, a lot of the churches in the U.S. Dominate people's thinking when it comes to the Middle East, and in my opinion, inaccurately. But I think thinking people will start to realize this is insane. This whole concept of forced speech is insane.
Well, you know, I hope that everyone on this program knows and will come back to it, because there's always a space for free speech, not enforced speech, on this program. Many thanks to my guests in Paris, New York, and in Lake Jackson. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.